ka hoki te rai tangata, ka hira te rai kai.
When human importance recedes, that of food increases.
E ngā iwi o te motu, tēnei te mihi ki a tātou katoa, nau mai ki tēnei hōtaka a Te Ahi Kā. Ko Justin Murray aho.
And I'm Maraia Rakraku, and you're listening to Te Ahi Kā, the Kaupapa Māori program on Radio New Zealand National.
I've spent the last 10 years focusing on iwi politics, and that is the hardest arena to work in because of the damage done to our people by colonialism. You know, there's scramble for mana, scramble for power, backbiting, bad behaviour, calumny, detraction, gossip. Those things are rife in many of our iwi. And those are the remnants of colonialism, that the mana rangatira has been put down, that rangatiratanga is about noblesse oblige, doing your best for other people, not just yourself. And we have got to restate that and reinstate it.
Now there's a voice that should be familiar to a few of you because for the past 50 or so years, he has been a constant in newspapers, magazines, television and radio as one of the key commentators on Māori issues. Ko te mea tuatahi. Being a Māori is...
having the greatest grandparents in the world.
Respecting your elders because they have earned it.
Having 250,000 brothers and sisters.
Fouling up the government and its statistics.
Having nowhere for the kids to go and getting a visit from the police who want to see them.
Not laughing at your children when they mispronounce your language.
Talking tough.
Not giving up the struggle for survival.
Waiting patiently for another nata, buck, or te kōtsi.
To love power and muscles, and to be told you have to have a Pākehā permit.
To know the difference between a Māori Pākehā, a Pākehā Māori, and a Pākehā, and to beware of the last two.
To never drink alone.
To be able to dodge daggers at Pākehā social gatherings.
To listen to all white administrators and Uncle Toms tell you that we are all New Zealanders and not to know what that is.
To pray to God before a meeting.
Having a Pākehā tell you it is wrong to believe in more than one God and listen to him tell you about God. Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, the Virgin Mary, St. Patrick, St. Francis, Joseph Smith, etc.
To welcome a Pākehā at a marae with the height of Māori poetic art, and to receive a cup of tea conversation in reply.
To miss work because so many of your relations are dying.
Fighting for the New Zealand government to save the country from the evils of communism and fighting the New Zealand government to save your land.
Owning land and not being able to use it.
Going to school to eat your lunch.
Watching the teacher teach the other kids.
Punching a Pākehā in the mouth for saying you are dumb.
Getting your Pākehā spouse to go and ask the landlord for the flat.
Belonging to a particular tribe which is the best in the country.
Believing that your canoe is most certainly better than the Queen Mary.
Having your friends and relatives accuse you of being a traitor if you earn more than $7,000, wear a tie and drive a new car.
Thinking there's something wrong with your television when it appears to be always hooked up to Great Britain.
Watching Tarzan save Africa.
Liking Air New Zealand's tail.
Feeding everyone who comes to the door and hunting for your best china for the Pākehās.
Running yourself broke to service the marae to service the whole world.
Being Māori is hard. Being Māori is sad. Being Māori is to laugh. Being Māori is to cry.
Being Māori is forever.
What you've just heard was written by Ranginui Walker in 1978 and published in his book Ngātou Tohetohe, Years of Anger. At the time he wrote it, he was the chairman of the Auckland District Māori Council, a position he held from 1974 until 1990.
He was also writing for The Listener with the regular column that formed the basis of his earlier books, the one we just mentioned, Ngātou Tohetohe, Ka Whawhai Tonu Mātou, Struggle Without End, and Ngā Pepa a Ranginui, the Ranginui Walker Papers. You'll hear later on how he believes having his work in print serves a higher purpose of always being on record.
Keep in mind that what you've heard was pretty controversial, eh, in those days. Having a Māori disagreeing with mainstream Aotearoa was virtually unheard of, especially doing it so publicly.
And believe me, as you'll hear a little later, it took a toll on his family life, but maybe not so much when you see how everything panned out with his whānau, and I guess you can attribute to his handling by some kaumātua when he was a young fella.
Now, last week I was at an event honouring Ranginui for his years of work and the contribution he has made to mātauranga Māori. But first, let's hear as he relives some of those early childhood memories.
Grab a hanky, because it's a tearjerker.
E ngā rangatira o ngā karangaranga maha o te motu. Tēnā koutou, ko tau mai te rangi nei, i te whakanui tēnei rangi whakahirira mō tātou te iwi Māori. I can tell you, it's a long way from the Rahui Valley to Wellington. I was brought up, and in fact I think I would be one of the last of the generation that was brought up in a traditional extended whānau hapū situation at Rahui. Why was that? Because the major portion of our land was confiscated by the Crown in 1865, and six hapū were jammed into the Waiowa Valley and the Rahui Valley and on the tableland at Omaramutu. Living at a subsistence level. In my household, there were two kuia with moko, and they were most indulgent towards me. There was also a koroa, who seemed to spend most of his day locked away in a room, singing mō teatea, what seemed to me, as a 4 or 5 year old, songs of a bygone age. Then there was an uncle and his wife and their son living in as well. It was a loving, safe environment. Everyone in that valley was whanaunga, were uncles, cousins, kuia, koroa. We shared things. Most of you know about that. Tēnei mea te manaaki, te whanaungatanga, te arahoki te tangata. My father would come back from the bush with a piko full of kereru. We'd sit down and have a kai, and then the nannies would peel off the skin off the legs of the kereru and rouge my cheeks with it, and then send me down to the house 100 metres away where my granduncles were. And when I arrived with the red cheeks, they knew there were pigeons waiting for them. It was an ideal world. I was never beaten as a child. There were no child homicides in that valley. But it was an unreal world. Because outside was the real world, dominated by the coloniser. In the end, my father's Lebanese uncle came and fetched him and said, hey, you can never get ahead as long as you're having to feed the whole whānau. So he abandoned the little farmlet to his brother and we went to the other side of the town to live at a place called Kukumoa, where all the military settlers had taken up their farms. I was only 5 years of age when I abandoned that place of nativity, that nurturing place. And I soon realised that this other was the real world, because all the power brokers were Pākehā, the school teachers, the policemen, the judges in the courts, the shopkeepers. They controlled everything. So I realised that this was the world that I had to live in, come to terms with, and deal to. And so I worked hard at school and was always near the top of the class and was eventually sent away to St. Peter's. So age of five, I had separated from my umbilical cord. At the convent school, the very first day I was there, I found out why it was my town cousins, none of them could speak Māori. Because I was immediately dragged before the nuns and castigated for speaking Māori. Not punished, but ticked off. And that's psychologically damaging in itself to a five-year-old. So the natural response to that is to suppress your language, to suppress your culture. This is the world I'm going to succeed in. Then I was sent away to St. Peter's Māori College. That caused further alienation. I talked earlier about the kumara. That was about the extent of my Māori knowledge. I never had the time to go with my father into the forest to learn the forest law. So that part of the mātauranga Māori was denied me while I was sent away to college to learn Pākehā knowledge. And when I came back for the holidays, my mother put me to work in the local Shelfoon and Francis store, and I was welcomed by Edward Francis. Oh, haramai rangi te Pākehā. I didn't understand what he meant. I was just being me. But that's how strongly I had been influenced by Pākehā education. Then I became a teacher. Now, there's very few of you in this room who can remember the time of our oppression and domination in the 1950s and the 1960s. We had this huge monkey of British imperialism, colonisation, sitting on our back. That the discourse was one way we were being defined totally by Pākehā. As an up-and-coming teacher, I'd be invited to in-service courses. And there, they were talking about the work of David Reisman, about children being culturally deprived. And here am I saying, no, I'm not culturally deprived, I'm culturally different. But it's very difficult to tell the dominating class there is another world, another worldview, another reality. Then later on, I was put on the National Advisory Committee on Māori Education that advised the minister. And Tūrua Royal and I were on that committee. And we would make wonderful resolutions about how to fix the world from the Māori position, and we would go away and Pākehā administrators in the Department of Education just picked out which resolutions they would follow through. And the main ones that we thought would bring about transformation were left untouched. So I had the feeling of always being on the wrong side of the table, like Oliver Twist as a supplicant. Then in 1992, I was invited to Wellington to meet with John Hood, the CEO of NZQA, and invited to become one of the chairmen for the panels of degree accreditations. We were inducted, told what the job was, and then I was asked, how much would you like to be paid? Now, I'm not one to talk of money. I said, well, I don't know. You tell me. And he offered me two levels of payment. And I gasped at the levels of payment. I said, oh, the lower level one would be fine. And so I agreed to do this job. And I thought, by kare, tino nui pui ate pū te a tēnei ngārara kia nei ko NZQA. But when it came to the very first degree we did at Awanuiarangi, the quality analyst was Helen Patterson, the sister of the Governor-General, Dame Sylvia Cartwright. She was a lovely lady, but it wasn't until years later I found out she was dyslexic. And then I learned about the era of user pays. We were welcomed at this marae, and there on the pipeline was Sid Mead. And this is what he said in the Whai Kōrero. We are a poor people. We have no money. We need you to approve this degree so we can get the students to get the money to pay the teachers. So I just went like that. Message understood. Then in the course of the hearing, I learned from Helen that the applicant institution is up for a pūtea of upwards of $20,000. The accreditation costs to assemble the panel, their travel, their accommodation, their daily payment. And I was aghast at this. Here was this institution saying, we've got no money, and how are they going to pay for this? So I immediately said to the Māori members of the panel, and this is one of the good things about NZQA at that time, they had the wisdom to pick a mainly Māori panel to do accreditations for wānanga, which made it easy, because we understood what it was about. And I just suggested that we forego our daily payments for this hui, which they agreed to. And that's the commitment that we made towards the struggle. A few years later, I was incensed when this CEO from NZQA, I think his name was Blackmuir, was flying backwards and forwards across the Tasman. I was so angry about it, I wrote to Helen Clark, the Prime Minister, and said, hey, this is the sacrifice that some panellists are making. We're not accepting the full payment in order to support the wānanga to survive and to get going. And that's always been my kaupapa. Even though I believe that a man deserves payment for a good day's work, but in actual fact, we only took half pay when we worked for wānanga as a contribution to the struggle. The second degree we did, excuse me, the second degree we did was at Wairiki Polytechnic. Whare Huia was with me. We were formally welcomed on the marae. Now, everywhere you go, you get welcome from just ordinary whakatau in a room to a pōwhiri to a challenge. We had three wero that day. And I thought to myself, gee, that's for Governors General, not me. And believe me, the Arawa paipai is quite intimidating. All these dressed in black, all these men, all these women. And in the Whai Kōrero, they admitted their weakness. We've come to support this degree, to put our wānanga in here to be taught. Why? Because we have no speakers on our marae. They're dying out. At the end of it, I turned to the council member. Do you understand the obligation that's being put here? These people are giving you their knowledge, pardon me, to transmit to the next generation. That's a grave responsibility. It's all right, you've got a Māori CEO in Albert Tahana. He's put a marae in place. He's got a kaumātua in Hiko Hōepa. What happens tomorrow when he's gone? And no sooner said than done. Constructively dismissed. They're still paying for it, Toby. Last year I was asked to audit Wairiki. Oh, it's okay. Okay. Yeah, the trouble is, you see, I got a Ngāpuhi bug from... Warm water, yeah. The tribunal hearing a couple of weeks ago in a tent, wet, windy, all that big hongi lying up. Ko weru here the mata. So last year I audited the wana, Wairiki, and I pointed out what they had done. They shot themselves in the foot when they constructively dismissed Arapeta. Ngāti Pikiao had seceded and gone to support Aotearoa Wānanga in Rotorua. Adohapu followed suit. I duly delivered my report, and then last year when Albert died, we went to the tangi, and I was gratified to learn that the CEO had gone to the tangi and apologised to Te Arawa. That, to me, is bringing about an important transformation in our society and our culture. One of the degrees we did at Wairiki was a Bachelor of Māori Tourism. And that was Albert's idea. So we sat and heard all the evidence. And one of the panellists was from Otago University, who taught a postgraduate degree in tourism. And the thing about universities is they're very jealous about degrees. They had a monopoly on degrees. It was the universities who laid down the parameters for degrees, how many hurdles there were and how high the hurdles were. And I know from inside experience, they were never like that themselves. So there was this huge requirement put on these new institutions that had no experience. And so we had this academic, his name was Phil Kearsley from Otago, who adopted the gatekeeping role on behalf of the academy. And as we hear the evidence, gradually a consensus builds up, yes, we will approve this degree or not approve it, or we will approve it with requirements and recommendations. So we're getting to that point. But this gatekeeper was insisting on his kaupapa that the teacher of the degree had to have a PhD, the leader of the program. So we had no quarrel with that, and that became the requirement. So I read my report out, and when I finish, up jumps Albert. Eki eki, ko wai koutou ki te tohutohu mai a mātou. We're the experts on tourism. You don't tell us. And this poor Pākehā fella, he was at the door waiting for a fast car to get him to his airplane. And he didn't know where to stand and fight for his kaupapa or not. So those are some of the hard case things that we did in those NZQA hearings. But for me, the most important thing about it was empowerment of our people to getting this monkey off our back. When we were doing those degrees in Wairiki Polytechnic, we had an all Māori panel except for one Pākehā, and he was learning the Māori language, and we were able to conduct business in Māori. Now, that's a first in New Zealand education, to conduct your business entirely in Māori. So that is part of the cultural comeback in our own time. I was also part of the New Zealand University's academic audit unit at that very time. And there was a head of that unit whose name escapes me, David somebody. And he was a driver, and he had a treaty section in his audit. And I learned a great deal about that, of ensuring that institutions were treaty compliant. in due course, I was invited to do a treaty audit when I retired in 97 by Otago University. So I go down there, I'm welcomed at the airport by the assistant vice chancellor woman. We go to the university, I'm led into the deputy vice chancellor's office, and I see two Maori sitting on one side. And I wait for them to stand up and mihi to me. They don't. Culturally unsafe. I couldn't mihi to them. And I knew they were Ngāi Tahu Pakeke. One of them was Ellison, Edward Ellison. So that goes into the report. Years later, when I ran across Janine Hayward, who's a political scientist, I said, "How are you guys getting on?" "Oh, we're still working through your resolutions." So bringing about social transformation is slow, hard work. Then there was a situation of a trial of charters and profiles in the South Island. So 10 institutions were picked out. And it took place in the Ngāi Tahu board offices in Christchurch. And as I was going in, I run into Te Maere Tau. I said, "Te Maere, how are you getting on?" "Oh, okay, what about that audit I did?" He said, "I produced a treaty paradigm for the university. I put it to the vice-chancellor, and he turned it down." I said, "What? See how hard the struggle is?" And so Te Maere resigned. And that pulled out Ngā Tapu Ai Orehua from their relationship with that university. And here they are fronting up to an audit, talking that they are treaty compliant. So NZQA, I've done this work now almost 18 years. This is the 18th year. It's been a learning curve for me, for you, for all of us. But above all, it has been empowering for Māori institutions called our whare wānanga. And I like to congratulate the people who formulate the degrees, who lay down the policies in those wānanga to meet the compliance required by the universities. The sad thing about universities is that they don't live up to their own quality assurance mechanisms. When there's a dispute, a long-running fight in a department, it could go on for 3 years before they decide to do anything about it. And they call in an audit. And even then, when the recommendations are laid down, they mightn't always follow them out. In one instance, we made certain recommendations about redeployment of personnel to keep this going. And I'm talking about Victoria University, which had the first social science degree in that university that produced people like John Rangihau, Ngā Maru Rairino, Anne Delamere, who had a great part in assisting our people throughout the 50s and the 60s. They abolished that program, and so we're all the poorer, simply because they couldn't settle a fight within their own ranks. Now, despite that, of course, the universities are the academic keepers of the flame. They provide the benchmark that we aspire to. And I'm satisfied that our wānanga are treading that path. There is a tension trying to meet NZQA requirements, degree requirements, but also āhuatanga Māori requirements. For instance, when we did a Bachelor of Māori Business Administration at Waikato, I couldn't see any difference from that degree with that degree from other degrees. So I said, kei he te ahuatanga Māori, kei he ngā kōrero mō ngā puari Māori, mō ngā kaporeihana, Federation of Māori Authorities. So make sure that your curriculum incorporates the Māori world. So I think perhaps I'd better conclude at this point. Michael alluded to one of my regrets in life was not having the time when they were little to play with them, to do things for them. But when you do have times, sometimes it backfires on you. When we finally got the leisure time, we had our batch, we had our launch, and I promised to take the boys fishing the next day. Now, I've been a fisherman and a seaman from way back, never been seasick in my life. But on this particular morning, I woke up feeling a bit seedy. So I said to Deirdre, I'm not going fishing today. Oh, you promised the boys. Promise them. Yeah, okay. So we went out and we anchored and we started fishing. Didn't go very far out. I couldn't stand it. And then I started to feel queasy. Wanted to throw up. Do I throw up in front of the boys and show this weakness? Not at all. I thought, I know what, I'll climb through the front and I'll pretend to fix the anchor and have a sail over the front, over the bow. So we do that. And here's this little bugger, Stuart, peering through the window. Hey, Michael, my daddy's being sick. So they find out in the end that their hero has feet of clay. I'm sorry that I couldn't speak of many other things that would be worth putting in front of you today.
Ranginui Walker sharing some stories from his early life that I guess comes into play at events when you have been honoured and you look back on your achievements.
So at the event last week, Mariah, people got up and spoke about Ranginui, including his son, Professor Michael Walker.
That's right. And the room was laughing when they spoke about his signature steely gaze, the old sussing you out stare that, of course, I got when I nabbed him for a kōrero. I started off by asking him how he felt about the day.
Well, it's a wonderful day. I'm touched by the tributes. And it's a celebration of the growth and development of Māori knowledge.
I asked whether he felt isolated, being so outspoken publicly, about Māori and Pākehā relations at a time when no one else was.
That was certainly the case in the 1970s. And I was fortunate that I worked in a university where they have a value that the people who work in the university have the right to be the critic and conscience of society. And being Māori and being part of the Māori Council, I was able to do that. And I was able to speak from a position of authority as the head of a Māori District Council with something like 36 marae committees behind me. We would have our meetings, we would discuss the problems, the issues of the day, and people would talk for hours, and at the end of the day I would have to cut through all the words and decide, okay, this is what they're talking about, these are the resolutions of the day. And then those would go out into the public arena, and then we'd get feedback from the public, criticism, that's Dr. Walker's a troublemaker, a stirrer. But I was warning them of the anger and the resentment that was to come from groups like Ngā Tamatoa, the Māori Land March, and even right up into our own time, the foreshore and seabed hikoi. So I was part of all that from the 1970s right up until recent years.
And with all of that firepower that saw Rangi Nui Walker representing the interests of marae and hapu around the wider Auckland area, I then asked, what was the equivalent body today?
Well, the whakapapa is kotahitanga, kingitanga, ngā porupiti, the prophetic movements, rātana, the courts, young Māori party at the turn of the century, Māori councils, they died out. Māori Women's Welfare League just after the war, Māori councils again in 1962, and that's gone weak now and has been surpassed initially by the tribal council, the tribal congress, but that didn't last long. But the ethos continued, and it's now come out in the Māori Party, that's in Parliament, but also in the Iwi Leaders Forum. That's the whakapapa of Māori political movements. And so the Iwi Leaders Forum talks to the Prime Minister. Anei ngā kōrero a te ao Māori, this is what the Māori world is talking about, and this is what you should do about it.
With the level of fierce intellectual activism and historical knowledge associated with Rangi Nui Walker, I wondered if it was present in modern-day Māoridom.
Well, we saw evidence of it in the room today. There are people there who are doing a policy and political analysis of where we come from. The Kohanga Reo movement, it's not a total answer, it's a partial answer. Kura kaupapa, wānanga. But we still have residues of the colonial mindset that we have to deal with. Mm. And that colonial mindset, every now and again, surfaces as it did in the One Law for All debate roused in 2003, 2004 by Dr. Brash, and the racism and angst it stirred up in our country. Then the Foreshore and Seabed March, the formation of the Māori Party, which to some extent has released the steam out of that issue. But the issues are ongoing. The pain that Māori people suffer by from government policies, such as the imposition of higher costs for GST. It's the poor, the underprivileged, the unemployed who will suffer under that policy.
Which led me to asking whether Māori intellectuals have become passive and less outspoken than they've been in the past.
One of the problems is people are afraid of speaking out. If you raise your head above the parapet, you can expect to be attacked. And one of the most recent to be attacked was Rongo Wetere when he created the largest tertiary institution in New Zealand. Its numbers surpassed the Auckland University. They got a big slice of the budget, and those other institutions became jealous of it. They complained to the minister, and so the government attacked Rongo Wetere. And there was no one, not one member in that parliament, could produce a track record to match what Rongo Wetere did. From the time that he worked in the community for Pākehā, building swimming pools, raising funds for good causes for the general community, he was Rongo, the go-to man. They called him Rongo, the go-to man. But when he wanted to build marae on campus at Te Awamutu High School, none of his Pākehā mates wanted to help him. So he was left stranded. But he went and did it. Then he built the Kōkiri Art Centre, the Māori Art Centre. Then on top of that, he built the Aotearoa Institute. Then on top of that, he built the Whare Wānanga or Aotearoa. Now, these are tremendous accomplishments for a man who had no resources except the brains in his head and the power and the muscles of his body. Because in building the shed, which was the basis of the Kōkiri Arts Centre, he got his hands dirty in dismantling the building, shifting it, levelling the site, and putting that in place. So I would stack up Rongo Wetere's achievements in New Zealand against anybody, and he will come out on top.
describing a situation I wasn't aware of, combined with such intense intellectualism and the accurate memory of key historical events, I asked Anginui Walker, who held that position now?
Well, good question. I try to write this stuff into books. That's why I'm still writing books now. I leave lecturing and conferences to other people because it's time for the younger ones to do that kind of stuff for their reputation, for their academic growth. People ask me to go to conferences and do keynote speeches, but I refuse because I prefer to use my time and energy on, first of all, the Waitangi Tribunal, because that's settling our grievances, getting the history put on the table and into the record, and to NZQA degree accreditations for Wānanga and polytechnics, empowering our Wānanga to educate people who hitherto have been uneducated. That's empowering people because knowledge is power. The power structure is very seductive. I remember being put onto one commission, I think it was called the Queen Elizabeth II Trust. And all my travel was paid for, and we stayed in the Geyserland Hotel in Rotorua, flashiest hotel I'd stayed in for a long time. And on top of that, I was paid $60 a day for meetings attendance fee. Now, that was in huge contrast to the work I was doing in the Māori Council for nothing. In fact, it actually cost us. You know, we had to do our own taxi fares, find our own accommodation whenever we had Māori Council meetings in Wellington. And I thought to myself, Rangi, be careful. You might be seduced by this high lifestyle and power. And so I was always on my guard not to take such things for granted. For instance, even now, as a member of the Waitangi Tribunal, I have a credit card for taxis. Now, I have no trouble in distinguishing between my personal credit card and this tribunal credit card. I use it only for tribunal business. And when my wife and I, she always accompanies me on the tribunal hui, we stay in the same hotel, but when it comes to dinner time, she pays for her own dinner, so that no one can point the finger at me and say, oh, he's on the take. I think it's absolutely imperative that you keep your moral integrity on such matters. And if you are in a morally righteous position, and if you spend your life searching for truth, and when you find what you think is truth, you proclaim it, then you've done your social duty. And that is the strongest defence you have from public attack.
Having spent most of his career focusing on wider Māori issues, inevitably the focus narrowed to iwi politics in the past 10 years.
That is the hardest arena to work in because of the damage done to our people by colonialism. You know, there's scramble for mana, scramble for power, backbiting, bad behaviour, calumny, detraction, gossip. Those things are rife in many of our iwi. And those are the remnants of colonialism, that the mana rangatira has been put down, that rangatiratanga is about noblesse oblige, doing your best for other people, not just yourself. And we have got to restate that and reinstate it.
And as for his greatest accomplishments to date, well, whānau, of course, the very whānau he felt he neglected in the early part of their lives.
My greatest accomplishment?
A successful marriage.
Yes, yes.
A happy marriage.
A happy marriage, a successful marriage. And, well, I didn't have much time to play with my children when they were young, because I was too busy doing Māori Council work and doing my own professional work as well. So that's been my experience. But later in life, I was able to make that up to them. by taking them, my boys especially, taking them fishing. Successful grandchildren, and now where I'm looking at the next generation coming along, the great-grandchildren.
Ranginui Walker, nō whakatō here, calling it as he sees it, as usual. Nā mihi atu ki a koe e te rangatira. A nei rā, a Himiona Grace, with this week's whakatauki.
Okay, kia ora, ko Himiona Grace, tēnei, e mihi tino nui ki a koutou katoa, he uri nō Paraurangi me Pautama. Tēnā koutou. Ka hoki te rai tangata, ka hira te rai kai. When human importance recedes, that of food increases. To me, this whakatauki talks about the material world being more important than the spiritual world and the physical world. And when you put material things first, it's people who sort of suffer for it.
So e ata mātou wāhanga te ahi kā, he tuku mihi tēnei ki ngā kai kōrero, me ngā kai rā wikiwiki mihini.
Hoki mai hei tērā wiki,
mauri ora tātou katoa.